This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of April, and this week, President Trump changed his mind a lot. First on healthcare, here's President Trump speaking this week before meeting with Senate Republicans.
Let me just tell you exactly what my message is. The Republican Party will soon be known as the party of healthcare. You watch.
Then, days later...
So if we get back the House, and on the assumption we keep the Senate and we keep the presidency, which I hope are two good assumptions, we're going to have a phenomenal health care.
Did Mitch McConnell ask you to delay this?
No, I wanted to delay it myself. I want to put it after the election because we don't have the House. So even though the health care is good...
Trump also reversed course this week after threatening for days to close the border with Mexico. On Thursday, Trump said he would give Mexico 1 year to stem the flow of drugs into the U.S. and help with immigration, or he would impose tariffs on cars imported from Mexico or close the border. Okay, let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
On today's episode, Joan Biskupic, CNN legal analyst, has a new book about Chief Justice John Roberts and how he's now the Supreme Court's ideological center. And then we're also going to talk with sports columnist Rick Riley about President Trump and his golf game. Rick says golf explains Trump, or specifically that the way Trump cheats at golf explains him. But let's get back to this week. It's time to take stock. Liz, what did we learn this week?
Well, we learned a lot about what Joe Biden's campaign for president is going to look like. He's still doing well in the polls, and that's not surprising as he has nationwide name recognition. But we watched a lot of claims, seven, I think, at this point surface, from women who say that Joe Biden, in greeting or talking with them, touched them in ways that made them feel uncomfortable. I don't think that any of these allegations rise to the level of an allegation of sexual misconduct exactly. They were just violations of boundaries and regular interpersonal weirdness that I think everyone knows Joe Biden is guilty of, thanks to the dozens and dozens of photographs of him doing this exact kind of thing that have come out over the years. Nuzzling women, smelling their hair, rubbing their shoulders, Eskimo kisses, sometimes kisses on the top of the head or cheek. He does the same thing with kids, though not as much with men. The weird thing I think about how Joe Biden has decided to respond to this is that he looks like he's taking a laugh-it-off approach, reminiscent of a kind of conservative tactic of calling out the snowflakes for being overreactive and rigid. I don't think that this is going to be a bad strategy in terms of appealing to voters that in 2016 Democrats were pretty furious at, but I think it's a strange bit of turnabout after Hillary Clinton's 2016 run to see Democrats in the establishment core turn towards it's funny and silly when people are upset about issues of consent and personal boundary setting. For me, if I was running the show, and I'm definitely not, this is not the fight I would want to foreground during the Democratic primaries. There are so many candidates who don't have this baggage. Whether or not you come down on this being immediately disqualifying for Biden, I think that what's going to proceed from it is going to be extremely divisive for the party.
I think Biden's reaction to this has been weird this week because, Liz, as you note, he was making jokes about it on Friday at this union event. But then he also released this kind of weird web video that was shot on some staffer's cell phone. And he's basically almost taking this Al Franken-esque approach. And I hesitate to say that because what Al Franken was accused of doing is worse than what Joe Biden has been accused of doing. But this sort of in-between thing where you don't really apologize, but you talk about how it's important to listen to the people that you upset. And then you also explain why you did what you did. And then Biden is there saying, well, I'm going to do different things now. And then he goes out and makes jokes about it. It feels like you have to pick a line about what you did. Either what you did was fine, and then you defend it and you go out there and you look like a person who, you know, has the courage of your convictions, or what you did wasn't fine and you apologize for it. It's really weird to sort of try to do half of each at the same time. I don't think that's really convincing to anybody.
It seems to me it is kind of a tweener, right? Because obviously it's inappropriate and it's wrong and you shouldn't do it, but it's not sexual. It's not malicious. Some of these Me Too cases that haven't involved, you know, actual sexual assault have obviously involved conduct that was meant to humiliate women. I don't think that's what Biden was trying to do. I think the ultimate source of this is he kind of imagines himself as like the great father of his people, or almost like a pope-like figure where everyone's so into him that they inherently view him as this comforter and encourager, and he's doing everyone a favor by Eskimo kissing them or smelling their heads or hair or rubbing their shoulders. What I was struck by in the video, though, and this is like completely superficial, but man, did he seem old, really old in that video.
To Rich's point,
definitely.
To Rich's point about him assuming that people want him to do this, I mean, in some cases they did, and I think that reinforced it. And I think partly when you're vaunted in public life this long, you can lose a little bit of touch about how people relate to you.
Completely.
But like one of the images that gets recirculated a lot is of Stephanie Carter, who's the wife of former Defense Secretary Ashton Carter. And as Ash Carter was being sworn in, Biden sort of came up behind her and was rubbing her shoulders, and people circulated the photo of, oh, you know, here's Joe Biden being creepy, and Stephanie Carter is out saying he wasn't being creepy. We know the Bidens well. I appreciated the comforting. But I think the thing is that, you know, Biden sort of extrapolated from the fact that some people were comfortable with that and sort of just assumed generally that people would be.
And the first woman who came out who said that she was Eskimo kissed at this fundraiser, it's funny, she talked about when she mentioned this to people and thought how weird it was and kind of felt it was inappropriate and felt kind of wrong about it. Some people said, "You're lucky, you know, Joe Biden Eskimo kissed you. How awesome was that?" And just Biden assumed that was the reaction of everyone.
Liz, when you say you think that laughing it off might be an effective strategy, it feels like that's something that's going to be poorly received by a lot of the Democratic primary electorate. I mean, I guess that's your point about it's going to be a divisive fight.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I mean, is that there are a certain number of people who might vote Democrat or have voted Democrat. You know, we know that about 9% of Obama voters went to Trump, for instance. So there are people who are potential Democratic voters who probably do think the Me Too movement is obnoxious, that the sort of attention given to women who come out and say, look, this made me uncomfortable, is overdone and is exaggerated and has to do with a certain fragility and snowflakiness, especially among millennial women. And they'll probably really appreciate that Biden seems to think the whole thing is a big joke and that he's above it all, that he's not really apologized. He's not supine, as Nate Silver said. He's sort of saying, yeah, well, I'm sorry you felt that way. And so there's definitely a chunk of people who are going to respond to that. But then there's this other chunk of people, and I don't have estimates on sizes, who are going to take real offense to it precisely because they feel the Me Too movement has made quite a bit of progress in getting women's claims about their experiences taken seriously in public life. Like I said, none of these women have said they were sexually assaulted. I don't think you have to take it that way. It's like Rich was saying, it's more of an issue of someone who had so much power, they never really had to consider how they were making people feel. Is there a gendered element to that? Sure. But a lot of it's just about sort of power simplicator. Instead of taking it in that direction with Biden saying, I'm sorry, I was kind of thoughtless, it was a mistake, he's laughing about it and saying, well, sorry, you felt that way, which is going to move it, I think, into this realm of conversations about consent and boundaries. In fact, Biden is using the word consent to joke about it on stage, right? Saying, I got everyone's consent before I gave them a hug. That's going to shift it towards being a conversation about something that he probably really doesn't want to have a fight about. But that's one of the many ways in which his response has been very odd.
Rich, what did you learn this week?
Well, we learned that the border is completely out of control. We had in February 76,000 illegal border apprehensions, went higher in March, and the president is just absolutely desperate to find some way to address this. And he's run through all sorts of things, and over the last week or so, it was closing the border, which is absolutely terrible idea. It was such a bad idea, it was actually successfully talked out of it by the rest of the party, but there's really nothing that can be done short of Congress passing a change in the rules dealing with this subset of migrants from Central America that are part of family units. Short of that, this flow will just keep on coming. It'll abate some in the summer months, but will be higher in the fall. And there's some estimates that we could have a million over the course of this fiscal year.
Liz, this is something that's been strange to me about the president's border crisis rhetoric, because there, you know, if you don't want to call it a crisis, there's certainly a large problem at the border right now, and the change in who's trying to come across the border, and when you have these, you have family units, and you have people seeking asylum, it imposes different logistical challenges on our, you know, our government officials at the border than patterns we've seen with immigration, both legal and illegal, in the past. And it feels like this was a challenge that the Obama administration confronted with some difficulties. difficulty and they did some things that upset the left of the party. But it feels like part of Trump's problem is that nobody trusts him with sort of the logistical powers that a president of either party might want to deal with this sort of problem, partly because of his outlandishly nasty statements about Mexicans and people of other ethnic groups, and partly because of just his, you know, the sort of incompetence of his administration.
I'm sure there's a multiplicity of problems. One of them is the lack of trust people have with Trump. Another one is that I think there are different views on how what's going on at the border should be framed. Are there problems at the border? I think there are definitely problems at the border. I think the opinion of people on the left tends to be that it's a humanitarian crisis, right? That you have lots of people fleeing violence and seeking asylum, entire family units, children coming across the border. And that appears to the left as a humanitarian issue the United States should respond to in the vein of responding to other types of humanitarian crises. I think for Trump and his party, it's purely an immigration issue. It's not really humanitarian in character. It's a problem of sort of bad people flooding into our country in an uncontrolled wave that's going to dilute our population, hurt our workers, and kill our innocent citizens. So I think those two vastly different ways of looking at what's going on at the border result in quite a bit of resentment and mistrust when it comes to placing the power in Trump's hands to deal with what people feel or what people on the left feel should be dealt with as a humanitarian crisis, because they don't think he's going to approach it that way.
Rich, Trump's theory here seems to be to threaten to do things until people give him the powers that he wants. And I think that was the idea with the border closure threat, that, right, you know, this Congress will pass a law to allow me to make the changes that I want about asylum policy and that sort of thing. That strategy is not going to work. He's tried this with the government shutdown and a variety of other things. Is there a tack that he could take here that would take seriously some of those humanitarian concerns? I mean, if instead of complaining that that we have too many judges at the border, if he said the backlog is way too long, we need a lot more immigration judges at the border so that we can impose these standards and actually do it in a way that allows us to process people in a reasonable amount of time. I mean, he's not going to have a compromise with Democrats about some of the bigger, you know, legal immigration level issues that Stephen Miller is very focused on. But it feels like if he took this problem seriously as being, among other things, a humanitarian crisis, there might be more room to work with some people in Congress.
Maybe. Now, the point of the threat of the border closing was not, you know, to sort of move Congress by hurting our own economy in border towns. It was to hurt Mexico and to get the Mexicans to police their southern border better because of the pain that would be caused by this.
Which, and Mexico has been stepping up.
Yeah, they've done more. But just the end of the day, it's they don't view it as their problem. It's not their problem. And, you know, increasingly, these migrants are transiting Mexico in buses, you know, so they're just a couple days from the southern border of Mexico to our border, and then they're getting into the United States mostly. I mean, there are problems in places like Tijuana, and they are keeping people who are applying for asylum at ports of entry in Mexico. But that's not the lion's share of these migrants. So there's just limits to how much I think Mexico is going to do. And I think in terms of the political framing, you're right, that would be better. Substantively, that's the administration's proposals. That's what they want. They want more money for all sorts of things that would have humanitarian effects and how we're dealing with these people once they get in. At the same time, they want tighter rules. And I think that would be the obvious solution. But just on the humanitarian front, our facilities are built with adult males in mind, not family units. So it's just a problem holding them for any period of time there. And two, just everything is being overtopped. It's not just the government's facilities. It's the private shelters and the humanitarian organizations just completely overwhelmed, and just people are being dumped in the streets because the numbers are so high.
So one thing that I think we learned this week is that some people on Robert Mueller's team are quite displeased with the way that Attorney General William Barr has handled their report. We've seen stories in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NBC News, all reflecting a view by some of Mueller's investigators that Barr has downplayed their findings. I actually don't see anything in these news stories that contradicts what's in Barr's two letters. In particular, the original Barr letter made clear that his view on obstruction was different from Mueller's view. Mueller could not see fit to clear the president on obstruction of justice based on the information that he gathered in his investigation, whereas Attorney General Barr believes the information does clear the president, or at least does not establish that the president committed an obstruction crime. So there is this unresolved question about obstruction of justice, which is why we need to see the report, why Congress needs to decide what what, if anything, it wants to do about the report. But Barr, at least officially, is on that page, too. He says that the report will be out in a couple of weeks. And once that happens, we'll be able to evaluate whether the Justice Department has been forthcoming, whether the redactions from the report are reasonable or not. My question for Rich is whether people have been too quick to be triumphal about the report from Trump's side. I think it is important on his side that these news stories do not seem to contest the no collusion frame. The NBC story says that some people on the Mueller team believe the Trump campaign was manipulated by Russian operatives, but none of these stories really seem to contest that Mueller did not find a collusion or coordination in the campaign. But it does seem possible that we're going to learn new, interesting, embarrassing things about the president's conduct during the investigation once we have this full report.
Yeah, definitely. As my colleague Yuval Levin pointed out right when the Barr letter first came out, these reports of this length, they always gain their power through their narrative and through their details. So it's going to be more damning of Trump than just the top line findings as they were summarized by Bill Barr were. But I don't see any conspiracy here. I mean, Barr, I take him at his word. He's going to release as much as he can. I imagine that you're going to have redactions, but it's probably not going to be, 50 pages totally blacked out, so you have no idea what the report was getting at. And there will be embarrassing details, especially with regard to the obstruction piece of this, but still the white whale, the thing that people are hoping would bring Trump down is not going to be there, the collusion or the conspiracy with the Russians in their interference in the election.
Liz, I feel like I've seen a lot of people on the left waving these news stories around this week and basically saying, see, the Barr letter was a lie. The report is terrible for the president, which also feels to me like a prejudging of what's in a report that we haven't seen.
If there's one lesson of the Trump era, it's that you never take a victory lap. So just because the initial report, for example, seemed to hold that there was nothing particularly damning, wasn't an occasion for a victory lap, although folks on the left did take it. I don't think that the reports that there's something else that we don't know yet that Barr concealed is an occasion for a victory lap. I want to see the primary documents. I think that's sort of the only hope we have of making sense of what we're actually dealing with. Everything I've heard has suggested that these are sort of judgment calls on how severe or serious what was found actually is. And so until they're distributed to the public, there's not going to really be any way to make any kind of judgment. And I wouldn't go off the word of anyone on the Mueller team.
It's funny, Liz, you say people on the left took a victory lap over the bars, over the letter seeming to clear the president. I couldn't figure out if you misspoke or if you're referring to people like Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, this interesting split that we've seen on the left among some people who never really liked this investigation very much or the line of thinking about the president being in bed with Russia.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. And there were a lot of folks on the left who had what I think are genuine grievances with the Mueller investigation, which is that, it seemed to take the place of a kind of left discourse that focused on issues. It seemed to kind of voiced hopes on defeating Trump onto this investigation and subsequent prosecution. You did see some material in that vein. And I think it was frustrating to people on the left who felt like, you can't really trust the FBI to take on the executive branch. They're not really going to do anything. Nothing's going to happen. Trump is not going to have a Katrina. It's going to just be a matter of winning an election against him. And so I think there was some exuberance. And I must say that the Mueller investigation did trigger what people on the left felt was a great deal of red baiting in sort of the old-fashioned anti-Soviet vein. A lot of Trump's a communist in bed with Russia. Now, this is all just confusion on the part of people who are pushing that kind of stuff. But you did see a fair amount of Trump with hammers and sickles and so forth meant to symbolize his relationship with Russia. And I think that also bugged the left.
I mean, he thinks the communist dictator of North Korea is a great guy.
Right. So why not go with that? Right. I mean, why pin it on the Mueller investigation? I would stipulate that the communism is not what he's actually fond of. It's more the dictatorship. But I think that all of those characteristics frustrated some folks on the left. And so they were maybe overly prepared to kind of take a victory lap when the original letter came out.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about John Roberts and the Supreme Court. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. In a controversial 5-4 decision this week, the Supreme Court said a planned execution in Missouri can proceed. This was despite the condemned prisoner's contention that he suffers from a medical condition that risks painful complications in the execution process. Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority, prescribed a high bar for such claims. The condemned prisoner must propose an alternative method of execution that is feasible and can be readily implemented. This case is part of a trend on the Supreme Court, with the court's liberal judges supporting restrictions that make the death penalty more difficult to impose, while the conservative majority looks for ways that states can overcome legal objections and proceed with executions. Anthony Kennedy used to sit in the middle of that divide, supporting some restrictions but not others. Kennedy has been replaced by Brett Kavanaugh, moving the court to the right and arguably placing Chief Justice John Roberts, a George W. Bush appointee, at its ideological center. We're joined now by Joan Biskupic. Joan is a legal analyst at CNN, and she's written biographies of Supreme Court Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, and Sonia Sotomayor. Her latest biography is called The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we get to the book, can you tell us a little bit about this week's death penalty case? How big a break is it from recent decisions that the court has made about the death penalty?
The court has always had a majority ready to uphold capital punishment. But your focus on Anthony Kennedy was exactly right, because he had expressed more ambivalence. This ruling by this majority had no ambivalence at all, and that's what made it so distinctive. And we've had a couple of other rulings that show that the kind of fluid, centrist, conservative voice of Anthony Kennedy is now long gone.
Liz, what did you make of this decision?
I think it's really disturbing. It's always disturbing to see the instruments of law, and especially the intellect of really bright people, marshaled towards the carrying out of obviously demented, torturous activities. I think that there's been a lot of success with conservatives fighting against the death penalty in the past few years. Several red states have gone ahead and abolished. I think New Hampshire very recently decided to abolish their death penalty. And with that trend happening at the state level, it's just very jarring to see a ruling like this, like Joan said, with very little ambiguity in favor of the death penalty, even as it begins to border on cruel and unusual punishment in a very obvious way.
Rich, we've also seen these disputes recently over religious chaplains present for executions, and a prisoner seeking the right to have a minister of his faith present and that being denied, which seems like an odd thing. Conservatives have been so focused on threats to religious liberty as they describe them. It feels like that's a small thing that the government ought to be able to provide in the context of an execution.
Yeah, so I think generally the death penalty is clearly constitutional and doesn't stop states from banning it, perfectly within their rights, but the Supreme Court it shouldn't be ruling that it's unconstitutional and it's not, and the Fifth Amendment explicitly contemplates capital cases. These two cases in Alabama and Texas where condemned prisoners wanted to have a spiritual advisor of their own faith, the Alabama decision, the court said no, the executions go forward, even though there's not going to be an imam there for you. In the Texas case, they reversed and said, no, Texas can't execute if they're not providing this Buddhist condemned person, a monk there at his execution. And it seems clear to me this is a First Amendment free exercise issue, and the court got it wrong in Alabama for what other reason, apparently because they kind of were hung up on the idea that the prisoner brought this complaint too late.
Yeah, it was a procedural
in the process.
Issue.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, they reversed and I think got it right in Texas.
Joan, you talk about the death penalty as an area where there's been a clear move to the right on the court, where there was an ambivalence before, and now with Anthony Kennedy gone, there is no ambivalence anymore. In that context, I want to ask about this broader narrative that we hear about John Roberts, which is basically that Roberts is a conservative, but that he's also very concerned about the court's public image, and he's reluctant to place the court in the middle of big political fights. And people sometimes talk about that instinct as in practice drawing him toward the center, that he's still to the right of where Anthony Kennedy had been, but that he's to the left of where maybe he used to be, left of other Republican-appointed justices. Is that narrative true? Has there been a substantive moderation of John Roberts because of his conception of what he needs to do as the Chief Justice?
In part, and I'll tell you, we have to look at individual areas of the law in their distinct context. We've just talked about how the death penalty, we're not seeing John Roberts inch to the left. But we will see him inch to the left, as he already has in a couple of orders so far this term. This is where I'd say he will not change at all. I would say on race, I would say on religion. Just to remind all of our listeners that he was the voice of the Supreme Court in 2013 when the justices ruled in the Shelby County versus Holder case to restrict a key plank of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. John Roberts has always been consistent on race, hewed to his conservative roots. I think in areas of religion, we'll probably see the same. I think in high-profile disputes, perhaps over the separation of powers, perhaps to send a signal to President Trump that he cannot count on this court to be in his pocket, as the president has certainly suggested, John Roberts is going to want to send a contrary signal.
Well, so where would he send that? I mean, I think the one really high-profile case of that sort was about the travel ban that the president imposed. And ultimately, Roberts and Kennedy with him handed down a ruling that allowed the president to do as he wished, even though Kennedy was critical of some of the things the president has said. What cases are you watching where you might see Roberts declare that sort of independence from the president?
Sure. And let me just say something about what John Roberts declared in that June 2018 travel ban ruling. He tried to argue that he had to vote the way he did because he had to treat President Trump as any other president. Sure, he acknowledged some of the statements that President Trump had said about against Muslims, both once he was in office and earlier as a candidate. And he tried to convince the public, I believe, that John Roberts and the majority were showing regard for the presidency. Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, essentially said, get real, you know, pay attention to what he said. He can't be treated like any other president. But that's the kind of line we're going to start seeing more of from John Roberts trying to argue to the public. The ones where we've already seen some orders where he's tried to avoid the court getting involved in issues, I think that's what we're going to. For example, he did not want to take up the case involving Planned Parenthood and states' challenge to Medicaid funding of clinics that Planned Parenthood runs. He's trying to extract the court from issues that could force more conservative rulings. For example, they've been also they've been sitting on requests from involving challenges to how far Title VII goes to protect people from job discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. I think where we're going to see it, Josh, is him trying to remove the court from certain conservative agenda items.
Rich, what do you make of that? John Roberts has come in for a lot of abuse from conservatives and from the president, basically contending that, you know, he's another David Souter, that he is not being faithful to what was expected of him as a conservative justice on the court. Is John Roberts performing as a conservative?
A kind of conservative, a cautious institutionalist. And I buy basically what Joan is saying about his general drift. One place I'd expect to see it perhaps is just taking a pass on hearing the national emergency case and, you know, letting presumably what will be, a stay of that national emergency in an appeals court stand. But I think this is kind of can fade into the least attractive aspect of him, which is detailed in Joan's book, which is just kind of the naked political calculations, say, that were involved in the Obamacare decision, where he clearly just wanted to find a way to wiggle out of what were his own considered constitutional views about the merits of the case, because he feared the political reaction of throwing the entire healthcare law out and what that would do to the standing of the court, and I fear also to his own reputation.
Joan, do you think that's a fair characterization of his thinking in that case?
Yeah, you know, I lay it all out, and thanks, Rich, for bringing it up, because we see that His vote was stunning in the end, but the way he maneuvered behind the scenes was equally stunning. As I document in the book, he switched votes twice. He then starts to work with more liberal justices to change not just how he had ruled on the individual mandate, as we called it, that's the insurance requirement, but also the major plank involving Medicaid expansion for people near the poverty line. And his actions led to so much distrust from his brethren on the right and a real bafflement among the colleagues on the left. And that lingers today. But I do think that case is instructive for where he sits right now, where he's trying to balance his natural conservative instincts, but so self-conscious about how the public is viewing the Supreme Court in our polarized times.
Liz, it feels like one aspect of that could be maybe welcome looking at it either from the right or the left, which is that ideally, if you had a less ambitious court, you might be able to de-emphasize the role of the court in national politics.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the great left hope. There have been some victories on the left coming from the Supreme Court in the last decade or so. But I think that there's a growing left consensus that the court is, you know, an institution that often challenges or runs afoul of popular sovereignty, that it's an elitist institution. That's a critique that Doug Henwood has made pretty emphatically. And you've seen similar critiques coming out of sort of left magazines like Jacobin and the Nation. I think there's a lot of validity to that. A less ambitious court, a court that's more wary of running afoul of public opinion, would be a good thing. Of course, there is also the issue that periodically public opinion is emphatically on the wrong side of issues. But generally, I would think a court that's less ambitious, less interested in running against popular sovereignty would be a good thing overall.
So, Joan, in using that healthcare case as sort of the key example of Roberts sort of casting about to find a way to get out of a political mess for the court, there's this additional challenge to Obamacare currently working its way through the courts that has been widely derided for its legal reasoning, even from some conservative experts, but at least a trial-level judge ruled in favor of those who are arguing against the law, ruled to throw it out. In the event that that case does reach the Supreme Court, should we expect that Roberts will want to continue to uphold the law given his rulings the last two times?
I think he would be inclined in that direction, especially given the Trump administration's switch in position on it itself. You know, just think, the Trump administration originally had said that only part of it should be struck down because of the new tax rationale, but is now arguing to the Supreme Court that the whole to a lower court right now, as a matter of fact, now arguing that the whole thing should be thrown out. And John Roberts struggled with so many conflicting feelings back then in 2012 over, you know, this was an important domestic achievement of the Barack Obama administration. It was trying to solve a healthcare crisis that he was so aware of. He was balancing so many interests. And I think those interests are even more at the forefront today, especially when you think of his rebuke of President Trump in November when he said, you know, we don't have Obama judges, we don't have Trump judges, we just have judges trying to do the right thing. I think he will continue to seek a middle ground. He's going to do it all the more self-consciously, though. I think he was already a very, very self-conscious of what history, what people were making of him today, what he thinks history will make of him in the future. And I think with everyone now knowing exactly all the switches that went on behind the scenes, he will be much more invested in trying to act like they're taking a high road. But I just do not see him striking down all of Obamacare as the administration wants.
Yeah, this case isn't going to prevail at the Supreme Court. And in part because I think people now realize everyone overestimated the importance of the individual mandate. The CBO constantly in all its evaluations of what Obamacare was going to do or what repealing it could do placed much too much emphasis on the individual mandate. The at least four justices stuck with the view in the Obamacare case that the individual mandate was absolutely crucial to the architecture of the entire law. And the fact is the mandate was always kind of weak and didn't make that big a difference. And now it's been totally vacated. There's no penalty, so it doesn't have any effect. So the idea that this now completely empty and sort of symbolic mandate is so crucial to the rest of the law that you'd have to strike down the rest of it if you find the mandate itself is technically unconstitutional just has no merit whatsoever. No, there's no way five justices will buy that.
Which is especially funny given the sort of legislative and policy history of the mandate, which is that back in the 2008 primary, Hillary Clinton and John Edwards ran on plans that involved mandates. Obama Obama's plan was not supposed to have a mandate. He beat them up over the fact that they were going to make people buy health insurance. Then he comes into office and turns around because it's decided the plan isn't going to work without the mandate. So he has to take all the political fire about putting that in there. And then a few years later, and it sort of looks like what props up the markets is the subsidies much more than the mandate. Joan, I want to ask you a little bit about the process of writing this book. You had 8 off-the-record interviews with the Chief Justice, but he didn't do an on-the-record interview with you. What did you learn in that process talking with him? Because publicly, he looks like such a he's a difficult-to-read figure. He seems very reserved. Were you able to get a lot out of him through those conversations?
There was a series of negotiations in our conversations of what I could put what I could use on the record without direct attribution, what those of us in the business refer to on background. He allowed material to be used, but he kept most of his remarks off the record. But just sitting with the man for that much time, more than 20 hours, some of these sessions would be 2 and 3 hours apiece, I really did get a sense of him. First of all, I knew he would be incredibly controlling, and he was, but there were different parts of his personality would emerge at different times. You know, sometimes he'd be as reserved as you just said. Sometimes he'd be, you know, a little, I'd felt that he would be a little more candid, but always aware of how he might be interpreted by me. I took extensive notes. He never took notes. You know that process that lawyers refer to as discovery? Mm-hmm. I felt that so much of what he was trying to do with me was discovery, because he was trying to figure out, what do I know? Who have I talked to? What have they told? What have they told me? Because a majority of his colleagues had been talking to me all along. As I, you know, from the day he became Chief Justice, I'd been getting into the chambers of the justices for my other books, and then also for this one. So it was there was always kind of a cagey dance between us, and I found that I really checked my personality at the door. I was very serious throughout. I had a mission. I wrote at the top of my notebook, remember, you're there to get information, not give information. And I used to think if there were thought bubbles above each of our heads, his would say, you know, I wish he'd leave. I don't want to go through this. And mine would say, I wish you were Scalia, because Justice Scalia had sat for 12 on-the-record interviews and owned what he had said. He really, he was proud of his rulings. He wasn't self-conscious about how he was going to be portrayed. He wanted to talk about his background. And just one last thing I'd say, Josh, is that I tried so much to find out what the chief had been all about as a young boy, his, you know, how he felt about his parents, his childhood, his mentors along the way. And if he had a message for me, it was that his background really didn't matter with him as a jurist now, that he has insisted, you know, in a public way and in a private way, that what you see is what you get. But when you look at how he acted in the healthcare case, it isn't just the umpire who he sets himself out to be. It's not just calling balls and strikes. Lots of other things factor into it.
Yeah, one thing you say in the book, right, is that his experience working with the healthcare industry sort of led him to feel like, oh, this is a complicated area with lots of gray, whereas in other issues he's able to be more ideological, right?
That's right. And in fact, I'm picking up on something that Liz had said earlier about the court's general tiptoeing to the left, irrespective of John Roberts. I would say Exhibit A for that is the 2015 ruling in the same-sex marriage case, where with the vote of Justice Kennedy, the Supreme Court ruled same-sex marriage constitutional. But John Roberts used that occasion for his very first dissent from the bench to say, do not celebrate this ruling. The Constitution had nothing to do with it. That's John Roberts also.
Joan Biskupic, CNN legal analyst. Her new book is The Chief, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. Joan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it is time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Brunig, what's your tweet of the week?
Nobody knew what had happened to Taylor Swift Updates, an account at Legit Tay Updates, when she disappeared from Twitter for a while, but she let us know this week. Update, she says, as most of you know, I haven't been very active in the past couple of months because I was in prison. I'm back now, though. More Taylor Swift updates coming soon. When a tweeter asked why, she said, I refuse to join the IDF, LMAO.
Rich Lowry, what's your tweet of the week?
My tweet is from my colleague Alexandra DeSantis, who tweets about the controversy over the so-called heartbeat bill in Georgia, restricting abortion. And she says, I love all these privileged celebrities trying to tell Georgia that the heartbeat bill is, quote, bad for business when they're the ones threatening to boycott the state over a policy they don't like.
My tweet of the week comes from Matt Pierce, who's a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. He tweets, may Caitlin Flanagan never find purchase to write about me forever and ever. Amen. Caitlin Flanagan has a must-read piece in The Atlantic this week about her time long ago as a college counselor at an elite private school in Los Angeles and the terrible behavior of a subset of the parents that she sees as foreshadowing the college bribery scandal that has befallen the nation in the last few weeks. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Rick Riley to talk about President Trump's golf game. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at The Washington Post. And we're now joined by Rick Riley. Rick is an award-winning sports writer. He wrote the back page column for Sports Illustrated magazine, and now he's written a book about golf and President Trump. It's called Commander in Cheat: How Golf Explains Trump. Hi, Rick.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So this is a whole book about how the president cheats at golf, and it's a fun book with a lot of fun stories. Tell us why this is important. The subtitle of the book says that golf explains Trump. How does golf explain the president?
Well, it's way more than his cheating on the golf course. It's his fraudulent claim that he's won 18 club championships. I don't know if you remember, but during the campaign, he would say, you need to vote for me. I'm a winner. I've won 18 club championships, and that's against the best players. But what he forgot was that he told me how he does that, which is that whenever he opens a new course, he just plays the first round by himself and calls that a club championship. And so I started looking into it, and a bunch of them were like super seniors championships, which is fine, but it's kind of the difference between Michael Jackson and Tito Jackson. It's not, you know, it's not near the same thing. And then he won one, I found out, from Philadelphia when they were playing in New Jersey, in Bedminster. He was playing Trump Philly, and he called up at the end of the day and said, oh, I played really well up here. Make me the champion down there for today. He I don't know if you know this guy, Ted Virtue, who was the money behind the Green Book.
No.
He won the Trump International, you know, the course next to Mar-a-Lago. He wins that championship, and he's a good player. He's like a two. And
when you say Trump's a two, he has a two handicap, so typically—
Which means he's really good.
Yeah.
Like Tiger Woods is a plus four, a scratch is a zero, two is really good. Trump says he's a two, he himself is a 2.8, which is a lie you could float in a Macy's parade, since Jack Nicklaus is a 3.5. So anyway, so he wins the tournament while Trump was in Singapore with Kim Jong-un. Trump shows up a month later. Ted and his son are playing the 12th hole. He drags the Secret Service and the SWAT over there, and the little scud bomb that's in the back of one of the carts, and the blood vials, and they're all like, he's like, what does Trump want? He's like, Ted, congratulations, but you didn't really win. You didn't play me. And he's like, yeah, okay, sure. He's like, no, let's play these last six holes for the title. And Ted says, oh, I'd love to, but I'm with my kid. He can play. And so they get to this one hole, they're tied, the kid's trying to play along, the kid and the dad hit it on the green, Trump hits it in the water. But with Trump, he's always got his caddies way ahead, the better to foozle and fraud, you know, and fudge and kick. And when they get to the green, Trump's lining up the putt that the kid had. And the kid goes, Dad, that's my ball. and Trump's caddy's like, this is the president's ball. And the kid looks at Ted and goes, Dad, that was a new ball. And Ted Virtue goes, oh, I'll buy you a new ball. And so then Trump makes the putt, wins the tournament, and then suddenly like rewrites history, and he's the champion. So how does it, what's it got to do with the presidency? Well, you know, I always say golf is like bicycle shorts. It reveals a lot about a guy. And what this reveals about him is he'll do anything to win. I mean, I have stories in there about not only just he kicks the ball so much, the caddies call him Pele. So he kicks the ball, he throws it out of bunkers, they throw it out of lakes, but he kicks other people's balls into the bunker so that he wins. So it's not so much he likes golf. He just has to win. And when I've watched his presidency, he wins. He's got to win. He's got to make it. I won the popular vote. Oh, I had the biggest inauguration. Oh, it wasn't my idea to cage kids at the border. It was the Dems' idea. He's got to end up on top. And the golf is just a perfect window into his soul.
Liz, do you buy this, the way a man plays golf as a window into his broader character?
That a man plays golf, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, you know that I have certain reservations about the sports of the bourgeois elite.
Let's talk about that because this is my another complaint. I love golf. I love public course golf. Tiger Woods brought the golf to people of color. A round of golf in this country averages at $39. That's 4 hours of a lot of fun. You drink beer, whatever. You play with your friends. It's great. So when Trump said he's going to make America great again, okay, knock yourself out. But he's made golf horrible again. He's driving on greens. He's driving on tees. He's wearing Dockers that are two sizes too small. He never walks. Real golfers walk. And as soon as you're done with the round, you post your score on the computer. He never posts his score. And that's how he says he's a 2.8. Do you realize it's taken him 8 years to post 20 scores, which is how you get your handicap, which is... he's a cherry picker. That's all he is. And it really just pisses me off that somehow people, like, sounds like you, Liz, think that this is all golf. This is not golf. This is elite. And by the way, he says golf should only be for those who make enough money to join a country club. I'm like, screw you, Donald. It's for everybody.
So let's test the hypothesis that the way a president plays golf tells us something important about the way they might serve as president. Because you go through in the book the history of different presidential golfers, and one thing is that it sounds like Bill Clinton is basically as bad of a cheat as Donald Trump. Whereas
I played with Clinton as president. His cheating was kind of different. He was so interested in getting better. Like we'd play for 5.5 hours. And he would take what we call Billigans. So he'd hit his first shot, and he'd play that first shot eventually, but he hit 5 or 6 extra shots just to practice, which is completely illegal, but doesn't really help you. It just exhausts you and exhausts the caddy. But then he would play the first ball. And that's different than what Trump does, which is he cheats you. He wants to win the bet. He wants to say he's better than you. In the book, I say it's like the guy that goes to the bank to steal the pen versus the guy that goes to steal the vault.
Wait, and so Trump is the guy who steals?
Definitely the vault.
Well, so one thing that struck me as a repeated theme in this book that I think is a repeated theme in his presidency is that he was surrounded by people all the time who know that he's cheating, and sometimes in ways that they actually find to be material. Like, their name's supposed to be on the plaque in the country club as the winner, and instead Trump gets to declare himself the winner. And it seems over and over again like everyone decides it's just more trouble than it's worth to try to stop the president from cheating. And I feel like you saw this in his business career that, you know, people would just know, oh, you know, he'll just sue and sue and sue and you might as well give up. And I think you see that in sort of the way that he steamrolls the media and the public by telling so many lies that it's difficult to even bother objecting on an individual basis. And so it seems almost like he wears people down.
Exactly. I mean, there's so many similarities to what he does as president. For instance, his caddies all get paid to cheat for him, and so they're kind of his Cohens. You know, they're always out there doing the dirty work, and then he can say, I never touched the ball. Well, okay, you pay your caddies to do it. And I snuck into the Bedminster caddy shack, and they all said, well, Trump doesn't cheat. We cheat for him. At Trump Washington, he put up this big, phony Civil War memorial about the Battle of the Bloody River, which never happened there. And so I was there this summer, and I saw it. But then I noticed that the coat of arms for the Trump family was similar to one I'd seen before, and it turns out to be the Meriwether family that owned Mar-a-Lago. So I called them up, and I said, do you realize Trump stole your coat of arms? And they said, yeah, but we didn't want to sue because nobody wants to sue Trump because you're in court for 7 years, and we just let him have it. And like, that's kind of, you know, like when he said the other day, windmills give you cancer. But he never mentioned that the reason he hates windmills is because they put up 12 windmills right outside his course in Aberdeen, Scotland, and he sued and bullied and threatened this and that to try to get him to take them down, and they never did take them down, and he lost the suit, and he lost all legal fees. I mean, when he talks about walking away from Puerto Rico, it's possible he walked away because he had a failed golf deal down there at Cocoa Beach in Florida that left in San Juan that left the Puerto Rican government holding a $32 million loan that was never paid, not by him, but by the people that owned it. But Trump said he was going to help them and just walked away. So how you do one thing is how you do everything. And golf gives you a chance to look at that.
Rich, what do you make of this thesis?
Well, just on wearing people down, I remember the first debate in the Republican primaries when Megyn Kelly famously asked that question about nasty things he said about women. And, you know, he just complained afterwards. And I wrote a column about how he was whining. You know, he's whining about, being in the big leagues where you get questions that you don't like. And someone asked him about this, and he said, yeah, I whine until I win. And that's, I mean, there's a lot to that. He just wears people down. He's going to be more committed than everyone else. And it's not just that he, you know, wants to win. It's that he wants the recognition of having won. And
yeah, like he doesn't, like if you lose to him, he often doesn't take the money and then he buys the cheeseburgers. But he wants you to acknowledge that he beat you. And since it's the Trump train on the Trump-named courses, as president, he's never played a course without his name on it. And it's his cheating cart where he's got this cart that goes 50 miles an hour at every course. And it's always him and the caddies way ahead. And so you got no chance. In fact, I bet him $100,000 publicly on Twitter that if he plays to 2.8 and I play to my 5.3, and we play a regular course, not his, and we're each followed by USGA rules officials, I say $100,000 to either guy's charity that I win, because I don't think he can cover that in a million years.
Rick Riley's new book is called Commander in Cheat, How Golf Explains Trump. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
We're entering campaign season, which means a lot of people are going to be getting bumper stickers. There's nothing I hate more in the world than bumper stickers. You take an already horrible, tense situation like driving on crowded roads, and then you add the only thing which could possibly make it worse, which is a public airing of people's stupid political opinions. Please do not piss me off with your bumper stickers. I can't respond. You're making a statement I can't answer, and I'm probably already upset about how you're driving. Just leave the bumper stickers off.
Rich Lowry, what's on your mind?
Unlike the left's other schemes to kneecap American institutions like the U.S. Senate and the Electoral College, proposals to pack the Supreme Court are constitutional. It's up to Congress to decide how many justices serve on the court. But if this is such a good idea, why not do it now? If they don't want to do it now and they want to wait until hopefully in their minds a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate are in place, then it tells you everything you need to know about this proposal.
For my rant, Ray Dalio keeps talking about politics and public policy. If you haven't heard of Ray Dalio, he's the billionaire founder of Bridgewater Associates, which is a very successful hedge fund firm and a very weird firm. Dalio has this management philosophy of radical transparency. If someone's bothering you, you're supposed to go tell them exactly what it is that you don't like about them. Meetings in conference rooms are recorded, so anybody in the company can watch them. You're not supposed to say anything behind anybody's back that you wouldn't say to anybody's face. It's apparently been successful there. But it would give me hives to work in a place like that, and I think that's true for almost anyone else. Anyway, I don't think Ray Dalio should be president, but I think it would be good for the country if he ran for president. He's out there saying things you wouldn't quite expect from a billionaire hedge fund manager, talking about how rising income inequality is a big problem for the country. He has some ideas about what to do about that. Again, running a hedge fund is not like running the country. I don't think he should run the country. But first of all, it would be nice to see a presidential candidate run on radical transparency, go around Iowa to diners, tell everybody how bad their pie is. But also, I think that unlike a lot of these other billionaires who think about running for president, his ideas might actually be positive for the conversation. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Joan Biskupic, and Rick Riley. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.